up, Sassenachs? It's Chelsea back for another episode of the Sassenach Files. This week, I'm discussing The Emerald Brooch by Catherine Lowry Logan. But before we get into that, I want to take a moment to remind you that you can find the Sassenach Files on all sorts of listening platforms, including iTunes, CastBox, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, and many more. Also, if you have not had a chance yet, make sure you head over to follow the Sassenach Files on both Facebook and Instagram to make sure you are up to date on all of the latest and greatest news concerning Outlander Season 7 and anything Diana Gabaldon cooks up. And with all of that out of the way, let's get into part two of my book club on The Emerald Brooch by Catherine Lowry Logan. How is everybody? After this week, I am taking a break for the holidays, so the next 2 weeks I will not have an episode of any sort. And then on January 7th, we've got a live with Angela to celebrate the 100th episode of the Sassenach Files. We're going to talk about Diana Gabaldon's time travel theory, I guess, if you want to call it. Everything in the universe of Outlander that has anything to do with time travel, including characters, mythology, what have you. So that's going to be on January 7th, which is a Saturday at 2 p.m. After that, I think I have a week off, maybe 2 weeks off, and then I'm going to start up with my coverage of the first season of Men in Kilts, and hopefully at some point we're going to get some news on when this second season is supposed to be out, but whatever. Today we're going to kind of pick up where we left off plot-wise, which was where Kinsey and David's story merges. And kind of the extraction plan, I guess, for David, because everything for him boils down to military terms. It's kind of a grab-and-go mission. Jack is supposed to be following Cav and Rayner and going back to Bassingbourne with them. And the plan is for David to follow Molly and Kinsey. And that leads them to Bletchley, but it's complicated. Let's put it that way. He doesn't want to tell Kinsey what his end game is because he's afraid that if she finds out that her dad sent him, that she'll run, which I think was a serious miscalculation on his part. I don't think that she would have. I think she would have been like, yes, get me the hell out of here, please. But at the same time, he doesn't know that she's not in love with Cav. And so he's trying to think on terms of what they went into this mission prepared to do, which was to bring the soulmates forward, not realizing that he was the soulmate in this situation, which I just find so ironic that they're literally beating it over the head with the fact that, oh, nothing's going to happen to Cav because he's Kenzie's soulmate and nothing bad happens to the soulmates. And they're completely overlooking the fact that David is the soulmate in this situation and the brooches are making things happen for him. Jack's confidence on the bombing run and all of that is... You just want to slap him. You're like, bro, I think you're misunderstanding this situation just a little bit. Nonetheless, Jack goes to Bassingbourne with Cav and Rayner. David follows Molly and Kinsey to Bletchley, which opens up a whole other can of worms. When David runs into Kinsey again, because he's intentionally running into her, am I the only one that took issue with this a little bit? He, by his conversation with her, puts together that she's stuck in the past. She's tried to go back multiple times with the brooch. It's not working. That should have been his clue then and there that he should have told her who he was, in my opinion. It should have been game over at that point. Okay, Connie's saying, yes, she's frustrated. Okay, because rereading this, I was like, bro, what? Why? And this is literally like every time I read this, I just don't understand why he felt it was unnecessary to tell her who he was when clearly she had tried to go back and that had failed. I don't know. There's so many times within this story that he should have told her and he didn't. And at the end, whenever he's beating himself up and saying, you know what, that's on me. Normally, and you guys, if you listen to my podcast, you'll know this. Normally, I'm a very sympathetic person and I try to understand where somebody is coming from. But this time, I'm like, yeah, it is on you. Totally 100% on you. Everything that happened to Kinsey, because you should have told her. I normally give quite a bit of grace But this, I can't give grace on. I'm sorry. And then whenever you throw in the fact that when he visits old Fraser at Fraser House and he tells him, oh, yeah, there are like 12 brooches, not three. All of a sudden, the situation becomes exponentially more difficult because Cav is no longer like pinned into this situation where if they get him back into the future, he can't come back because there are all these other potential escape routes for him now. Literally everything in this situation is telling David, you need to reevaluate this situation. Elliot told him, don't be closed-minded. You never know what's going on. You have to think and adapt and overcome. There are going to be things that you don't understand that you're going to have to figure out on the fly. And if you have a closed-off perspective on that situation, you're not going to see everything that you need to see. It's a lot more complicated than David likes to view it as, I guess. And that's really odd. And I'm glad that Jack sees it, even that David's not David. Once he meets Kenzie, as much as he is, and he's still resourceful, and he's still basically Superman, there are things about his line of thinking that is not necessarily David 1.0, I guess. He's not seeing all sides to a situation. He's being pretty closed-minded. He's making a lot of assumptions that he shouldn't make, and that causes issues later on down the road. So once they get to Bletchley Park, this is where I start hating on Kenzie a little bit. Because her whole story up until this point about being in the 1940s has centered on flying under the radar. She knows how much danger she's in by not having identification and being in London and the surrounding areas while MI is constantly on the hunt for German spies or Axis spies whatsoever. So she knows she's in a dangerous position. And then she just randomly decides, hey, you know what? I think I'm going to try to get a job at this super high security facility without any identification and see what happens. Okay. I don't know. I feel like that wasn't the best decision either. Like, yes, David should have told her who he was, but Kenzie also should have been a little smarter in that endeavor, I guess. I think that her own curiosity over Alan Turing and the work that they were doing at Bletchley Park was very alluring for her, especially with that puzzle solver, history nerd side of her. But at the same time, it wasn't a good idea. And she knew it wasn't a good idea. And she did it anyway. I mean, she has regrets about it later. She's like, you know what? It's not a good idea for me to be here speaking a variety of languages. I'm raising all kinds of flags for all these people in power, and I really just need to kind of make my excuses, hop on a train to Scotland and not look back. I need to really be concentrating on a way to get home because this isn't safe for me. And she's right, it's not safe at all. Now, granted, the setting is really cool. A lot of awesome things happened at Bletchley Park, and I didn't really know about Bletchley Park at all until I started reading this book. So Bletchley Park is actually credited with potentially shortening the war by up to 2 years by World War II experts. It's a 58-acre plot of land that the British government purchased in 1938. It's 50 miles northwest of London and accessible by rail via the service to Cambridge and Oxford. It's right there on the main path, not hard to get to, very accessible. It was originally a station in the government code and cipher school. So it was originally a place where people in military intelligence and government officials went to school to learn about code breaking and creating ciphers and important stuff like that, you know, super spy stuff. But after the war started, it soon became a place where the best code breakers and crypto analysts went to try to break the codes of other countries, mainly Germany. And that was really the work that Alan Turing and his team did. They were responsible for breaking the Enigma code that the Germans used to encode their messages. But I thought it was really cool, this particular fact, that prior to the war in 1939, Bletchley Park had 200 employees. By the end of the war in 1944, it had over 9,000 employees working 24/7, and 3/4 of those employees were women. So I thought that was really, really neat that women in particular were using their brain power, proving that they were more than just baby making machines that could keep house and run errands. So I thought that that was awesome. And it's really no wonder, I guess, when you look at it that way, why Kinsey was so fascinated by it. But also, having done the level of research that she did, she had to have known that it was so dangerous. And she's not stupid like that. You know, it just really seemed out of character for her. So while Kinsey's at Bletchley, she actually meets her grandfather, which is where all of this, all the plot lines that are being laid out in the first half of this book are starting to come full circle. She doesn't really know much about her grandfather, except that her dad doesn't really have many good things to say about him. She found that redacted memo, but because it was so redacted, she didn't even know who it was about, which is crazy. Like, how she found this memo. And I, again, has to be the brooches at work here, because the fact that she was able to find that memo, despite the fact that it was 90% redacted, and kind of use that in her thesis or whatever she's been working on for her law degree, is super crazy. But she meets Lieutenant Robert Manning at Bletchley while she's there and starts to learn a little bit more about him. She vaguely remembers this conversation that she heard her father and mother discussing, but she was only like 7 or 8, so wasn't really putting a lot of emphasis on remembering that conversation. There's distant bells ringing about the kind of person that he is. She knows that her father wasn't particularly proud of her grandfather. Remembers something about him being a traitor or him being a spy, some sort. But everything that she's reading from his personality, and remember, Kinsey is a trained people watcher. She was in the military intelligence corps while she served, and she is a very keen observer of personality, of habits. She can read a lot about a person based on the way they present themselves, the way they hold themselves, the way they speak. Everything that she's getting from Manning is a very different read than everything that she's been told about him previously. Manning was in the 2nd Ranger Battalion that scaled the cliffs at Pointe du Hoc on D-Day. And if you guys don't know much about the 2nd Ranger Battalion and Pointe du Hoc, I'll kind of give you the cliff notes because I'm not well read in this area myself, but I did kind of read an article or two in preparation for this book club. The Rangers landed on Omaha Beach, I believe. Their job was to run across the beach to the cliffs, scale the cliffs to get up to the top of the cliffs to spike the guns, the German guns that were on the cliffs there, to reduce the amount of fire coming at all the other people that were landing on the beach, because there were massive amounts of LCTs. LCT is a landing craft. So there were all kinds of LCTs and just sheer manpower, not to mention all of the planes coming across as well. So if you guys had a chance, and if you didn't, I'm going to highly recommend that you do. I posted a video on this group from the end of the first episode of Band of Brothers, where it is showing the sheer scale of the D-Day invasion. It's not violent at all. It doesn't show actually any of the D-Day invasion, but it does show you a wide shot of what it looked like as they were headed towards France. Has all the planes, all the ships, and LCTs. I had my mind blown when I watched that for the first time. I just recently watched Band of Brothers for the first time a couple of months ago because it was on my watch list, and it gives you a whole other appreciation for it. So I highly, highly recommend it. But anyway, Kinsey's grandfather was part of one of the Ranger divisions that landed there. They suffered extremely high casualties trying to climb this cliff. But basically, people were standing at the top of the cliff shooting down at them as they were attempting to climb. And when one man would fall, the next would get in his place and go. And eventually, just based on sheer numbers, they got to the top of the cliff only to find that the guns that they had climbed the cliff to spike were gone. They had been moved. They weren't there anymore. So they had to chase down the Germans. They finally got there. They spiked the guns. They ended up saving thousands of lives, but suffered severe casualties. It was kind of just amazing, right? And so you get that on top of the fact that this guy is extremely charismatic, funny, sweet, just an overall gentleman in the way that he treats other people. And something's not adding up. She's thinking to herself, this is not the same man that I had in my head, like that I've heard about my whole life. So there's a disconnect there. And she's very curious as to what that disconnect is. it's a puzzle worth solving is how she's looking at it. And she may even be willing to hang around Bletchley a little bit longer to see if she can kind of put the pieces together any more than that. One of the key things about Manning that is one of those pieces floating out there that she hasn't quite put into place yet. Manning married Della O'Brien, an Irish woman, and he's trying to get her citizenship into the U.S. However, when World War II started, all of that kind of got put on hold. But at this point, she's pregnant. They're trying really hard to kind of get her paperwork pushed through. And the quickest way to do that, that Manning has found so far, is for him to tap into his Irish connections via the IRA to share secrets with the Germans. He's passing them false information to lead them in the wrong direction. In doing so, the military intelligence has promised that they will help push Della's paperwork through because he's doing this work. So that's kind of where the disconnect is, because what happened in the original version of events before the future got changed is that Manning was shot in the process of doing this work for his country. And rather than reveal what really happened, the military, the government, threw him under the bus, said that he was a German spy, and he was disgraced. Kenzie's father grew up in a disgraced family. That had a profound impact on him. His mother had to work constantly to make ends meet as a single mother. She did eventually get her citizenship to the United States. They were good enough to pass that through, even though they're a bunch of bastards for throwing this guy under the bus like that, but that's another thing entirely. It's just a really shitty situation that nobody that finds out about this says, oh, I understand why that happened. Like, no, everybody's like, what a crock of bull that this good, sweet man, all he wanted out of life was to get his wife to a safe space. And in doing so, he put his life on the line, lost his life, and they didn't even give him the credit of being a national hero. They tarnished his name. That's unforgivable, in my opinion. And I know that that kind of shit happens all the time. It doesn't make it any easier to swallow. I was talking about how Kenzie thinking it was a good idea to try to get a job at Bletchley, it put her on people's radars that she should have never been on their radar. She did herself no favors by pursuing this job. She's automatically raising flags with Commander Travis, who has connections, obviously, because you don't become the commander of an intelligence center like Bletchley Park without being tightly ingrained with military intelligence. It didn't take nearly as long for them to figure out that she didn't exist as she thought it would, so she miscalculated that by about a mile. And she's abducted by military intelligence. Fedora, man. This guy's some bad news. He is so ruthless, and I understand that war is war, and you have to make decisions and do things that you're not necessarily proud of for the sake of winning. I get that. But being ruthless to the point of where you're torturing innocent people for information that they can't give you, that's not okay. And I think that's what David struggles with through all of this. He mentions that he had taken part in interrogations as part of his job when he was in the military, and it had never bothered him, mostly because he didn't know who was being interrogated. But also, when he was looking at what happened to Charlotte when they were in Washington, he could have killed those people with his bare hands. But this was particularly hard because they were his own countrymen. They were doing what they thought they needed to do to win the war. But the moral ambiguity of it all just boils his blood. They just treat her so awful. And I get it. This is history, right? And it's the darkest parts of our history. But holy smokes. They're not only using non-physical torture techniques like making her stand for long periods of time, starvation, stripping her, and basically letting her freeze her ass off just short of hypothermia. But they're also using physical blows, biting her breasts, masturbating on her, whipping her, and then you've got the waterboarding situation. I mean, we've all heard of waterboarding, right? I really didn't know the technicalities of it, and so the morbid curiosity in me Googled it. And this is what I found. So for those of you that want to know or are curious, it says, waterboarding involves strapping a person to an inclined board with their feet raised and their head lowered. The interrogators bind the person's arms and legs and cover the person's face. The interrogator then repeatedly pours water onto the person's face. The water may or may not get into the person's mouth and nose, but the physical experience of being underneath a wave of water is secondary to the psychological experience. The person's mind believes they are drowning. The gag reflex kicks in as if they were choking on the water, falling on their face. So it's more of a mental game than a physical game, although I'm sure that the physicality of waterboarding is absolutely horrendous, having cold water in your mouth and your sinuses and just being immobile and not being able to move while somebody douses you with water in your face. Like, that's awful, but it's really the mental game that you play. Catherine says, my goal as an author is to make characters suffer as much as possible. I get it, especially when you're writing historical fiction. So much horrible crap happened that you don't have to hunt very hard to find something terrible that happened at some point in history, you know? So anyway, this all happens to Kenzie while she's at a place called the London Cage. And the London Cage was an actual facility in London. I posted an extra on this if you guys had a chance to see it in this group, but I will kind of summarize the article for you. In Kensington Palace Gardens, it's some of the nicest houses in the entire UK. It's owned by the crown, the ground is. And during the Second World War, number 6, number 7, and number 8 made up the London Office of the Combined Services Detailed Interrogation Center, aka the London Cage. And it was in operation from July of 1940 through September of 1948. So well after the end of the war. So it was primarily a place where POWs from the German SS and the Gestapo were interrogated to give up secrets and admit to war crimes. 3,573 German officers were interrogated there, and more than 1,000 were persuaded to give statements about war crimes. However, a number of German citizens were also interrogated there. So that's what I was talking about this going 4 years past the end of the war, or 3 years past the end of the war. It wasn't just military personnel that were being interrogated here. Those three buildings would hold up to 60 prisoners at a time. There were 5 different interrogation rooms, and it was run by a man named Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Patterson Scotland, and he had 10 officers and 12 non-commissioned officers who served under him as interrogators and interpreters during that time. So it was a really nasty place. It was all very questionable what was done there under the Geneva Conventions. I can't even remember. There was a number how many times it was investigated for the things that went on there as far as like cruel and unusual punishment goes. And there was one man who he dropped off a German officer for interrogation there. He was very belligerent and stubborn and just, you know, tough guy. And when the same man came back to pick him up like a week later, he was docile as a lamb, would not make eye contact. Yes, sir. No, sir. It's just so crazy. I can't even imagine the things that happened there. Yes, Angela, it was basically the British equivalent of Guantanamo. Yep, pretty much. A terrible place for Kenzie to find herself. And David actually finds out that that's likely where they're keeping her because he finds the war trials transcript and all the information that he brought with him back to the 1940s. He finds that and he's doing keyword searches for prisons, torture, London, like all these different keyword searches, and he finds the London Cage. So he has a pretty good idea that that's where she's being kept. But then it just becomes a matter of, okay, that's where she's being kept. How on earth am I going to get her out of that? There's no freaking way that one man can break through basically what amounts to a maximum security interrogation facility. So this is where we really start to see the resourceful side of David come out, with him realizing that, yeah, he can go to SHAEF, you know, Supreme Allied Headquarters, and see how far he can get by kind of lying his way through it. And he tries, but it doesn't get him very far because finding one woman is not a priority when you're facing down the D-Day invasion. It's just not, okay? He's faced with two options. He can go to the press and leak Kenzie's story, or he can try to pay for some friends and go find her himself. And he decides that at the end of the day, leaking Kenzie's story probably would not solve very many problems because she doesn't have any identification. And if the press starts to investigate into this, they're going to find the exact same thing that the American Embassy found, in that Kenzie doesn't exist. And that's not going to help him at all. In fact, that's just going to bring more attention to the fact that Kenzie is a potential spy. So he decides to go his own way on this. And he hires a man named Teasdale, who is a detective who knows the underground pretty well. And he's able to come up with a plan. There's two women and two men. They are going to pose as prostitutes and provide services to the guards to distract them, while the men serve as lookouts for David, who's going to break into the facility and rescue Kenzie. I love how Teasdale is like, only a Scot could come up with this harebrained idea, and damn, I believe it might just work. It's gonna work, but it's flipping crazy. I love that the format of these chapters is that they're constantly swinging back and forth on this pendulum of Kenzie going through everything that she's going through and David rushing to find her. And then Kenzie going through some more horrible stuff, and she's really starting to lose hope because she doesn't think that anybody's coming after her, and she can put up a fight and resist. But at the end of the day, what does it matter if she's never going to get out? If nobody is going to come and save her, then she might as well just put an end to it all, you know? And that's got to be a really terrible place to be mentally, to know that nobody's coming for you. And she thinks that, you know, Cav can't really do anything because he's stationed at Bassingbourne and he can't leave, and D-Day's coming up. She thinks that David might make an effort, but he's probably not going to get anywhere, and he's got bigger fish to fry, so he's not coming after her. And it's really hard for her to not be hopeless in that situation, which is kind of where Trey comes into it. And I love this aspect of this book and a couple other books, but I'm not going to get into that. This idea of kind of like a guardian angel type situation, where people that are important to our main characters in some way, shape, or form linger after their death and watch over the person that they care about. Trey saved Kenzie's life in the suicide bomber incident in Afghanistan several years ago, and he's still with her. And at the beginning of this book, it's really easy to perceive that voice that she hears in her head as how she would imagine Trey would respond to a situation. But as we get further and further into this story, we start to realize that it's actually a lot more than that, and it goes deeper than that, and that he's actually there as a conscious voice, giving her advice, looking out for her, telling her, show no fear. Well, I didn't say to be that cocky, and telling her to duck when there's bullets flying overhead, and all of this. And at the end of the day, David actually hears Trey as well. So I thought that that was pretty cool in retrospect. And there's a moment where at the end of everything, they were talking to Cav and Molly, and David realizes that it was Trey that he heard in his head, and his chin quivers a little bit. And seeing this big, tough man realizing that he has a guardian angel, like, that's such a powerful experience for him. And it brought tears to my eyes seeing David realize that. They're totally both alive because of this man that kind of remains throughout some of the toughest aspects of this story. I also thought it was kind of cool that whenever we meet Cav and Molly later, Cav is saying how he's heard Trey and Susan talking about the danger that Kenzie was in and that it would be okay. You know, a 96-year-old man, it's easier to assume that that's kind of just him being out there a little bit. But then when you put it together with all the stuff that David and Kenzie have experienced as well, you realize that, yeah, those voices that he's actually hearing talk about all of this stuff, they're an intimately connected part of the story. And it made me wonder, because, you know, the brooches always have a purpose for where they drop people off. Obviously, Cav is not Kenzie's soulmate, so what was the purpose of dropping her in that time? And I honestly thought that maybe Trey had some bearing on that, because he knew that if Kenzie was with his grandfather, she would be safe until David could get there to bring her home. So I did kind of, like, I kind of wondered that a little bit. Like, I thought that that was I don't know. Maybe that's me wishing or thinking too much into it, but I like that idea. One massive theme in this book that I think is especially prevalent throughout the second half of the book is the idea of no man left behind. As I'm going through these, I'm like, these are a lot of things that are really like military ideas. And I was like, well, that makes sense given who our main characters are. But no man left behind is really just, I mean, think about it. We see it in how Meredith refuses to let Elliot leave Jack and David on their own. It's the whole reason that they were going to leave Kevin in Scotland. Jack helping to evacuate all the men from the B-17 after it ditches in the channel. David going after Kenzie all three times. We've really got that idea working hard. There's this moment for David where it says, Meredith's haunting words came hurtling back at David. Kenzie doesn't know you. She doesn't know you can work miracles. He wasn't a miracle worker by any means, but he had resources. And wherever MI had taken Kenzie, he would find her. She just had to believe she wouldn't be left behind. Without that belief, a soldier in captivity had nothing. So we see that, like I was talking about, that pendulum moving back and forth as these chapters switch points of view. There's always that through line, the commonalities between David and Kenzie. Kenzie is very much struggling as a soldier in captivity with trying to stay her ground and to not give in to this torture that she's experiencing. But David fully realizes that he has to hurry up and get there because she doesn't realize he's looking for her. And even Meredith has foreshadowed this again, as she's so famous for doing, that Kenzie doesn't know him. She literally doesn't know him. She doesn't know that he's from the future. She doesn't know he has any way of knowing who she is or where she is. It's kind of a hopeless situation for her, and I love that he does find her through his own means with this plan with Teasdale. But we also see the strength in the characters that he works with, because when all of these people that Teasdale finds to help carry out this plan come together, he's thinking to himself, oh great, like we got a bunch of street urchins basically, and how reliable are they going to be really? But we see their honesty and their integrity really shine through, and they're like, you know, we see what you're doing and we appreciate it, and we're not going to leave you to figure this out on your own. We're honorable in that way and we're going to help you out as best we can. It really shows this idea of people banding together in tough times to really figure out a situation. And I think that we see that over and over again, not just in this book, but in the series in general. Through one thing and another, David finds out that Kenzie's being kept on the second floor of house number eight, with the help of all of his people. Of course, because David's always prepared for every contingency, has brought heat vision goggles and shortwave radio communication devices. And he gives all of this stuff to his little team to be able to make sure this goes off as efficiently as possible. But at the same time, he also realizes that this is a completely terrible idea, because Teasdale, as much as he recognizes the value of what David is doing and that Kenzie is innocent and he's trying to prevent something terrible and irrevocable happening to her, he is also saying, look, like, I get it, but these guys are also British soldiers. They have a job to do and they believe in their heart that they're doing it, and we can't kill them for that. So you can incapacitate them if you want, but there will be no killing. So David is going into this situation blind and unarmed. Yeah, so he says how ironic the term disarmed was. And he said that he feels like he's operating with both arms tied behind his back because he doesn't have any weapons of any sort. And he says confidence was the only weapon he had. Well, that and a fear of failure as powerful as a tsunami. What he doesn't realize is that he also has Trey looking out for him, which is going to prove to be invaluable as well. He's the only reason that they get out unscathed. It's just interesting to see how David realizes what a clusterfuck this situation is, and he's going to go and he's going to do it anyway, because the only alternative is to admit defeat, admit failure, and let's face it, he's not going to do that. So he gets in, he saves Kenzie, obviously, because he's the hero of the brooch books. That's one thing that when Cav and Jack are on this raid and Jack just keeps thinking to himself, it's okay, I'm with Cav. He's the hero of the story. Nothing's gonna happen to me because I'm with Cav. God, he could not be more wrong. I'm wondering if that's the moment when he realized Cav was not the hero of the story, you know, as they're ditching in the channel and he's like, oh shit, bad things are happening. We could die. Maybe I was wrong. David gets Kenzie back to the Ritz. He's realizing, as I think he probably likely already knew from, you know, sitting on the roof of the building across the street from this torture facility and listening to the screams coming out of it, he likely knew that if he saved Kenzie, she would have some physical injuries, but that her real hurdle here would be the mental injuries that she had to overcome because of the degree of torture techniques that were used. As much as physical pain is a motivator for people, getting in their head is really the most efficient way, I guess, to get answers or to make them feel hopeless. That was exactly the game plan for what happened to Kenzie, and that's going to take a lot of time to overcome and heal from. And David realizes that. I think he is great with her in being gentle with her. You see him reminding her, it's okay, you're safe, you're at the Ritz. It's June 4th, 1944. This is what happened. Just methodically running through things with her, touching base, letting her know she's okay, she's been rescued. You see that gentling technique that he refers to earlier in the book of how he would deal with a spooked horse or a upset child. He's using that sort of soothing voice on Kenzie now as well. Let's see what you guys are saying. Claudine, the German Gestapo was even worse. Oh yeah, I mean, let's not even get started on that train. You see what the German idea of moral character looked like, I guess. At least the Brits had some rules, but they also realized what they were up against and that they had to play dirty to win the war. You couldn't hold yourself to the same standards that they'd been holding themselves to. Like I said, a lot of people did things that they weren't proud of, but it still didn't even hold a candle to some of the things that were being done. So Jack's ride along. Oh boy. You had to know if Jack Mallory was going along, everything was not going to be hunky-dory. He finds a way to get himself in trouble every time. That's just part of who he is. You can't rag on him for it too much because he just is so motivated for the story. He wants to put himself out there and get all the details and be in it. He doesn't really think there's any danger in it, like I said. He doesn't realize what he's risking until it's too late, per Jack. But I just thought, oh, Jack, as Connie said. And I love that as they're literally in their briefing for this bombing run, the colonel or whoever it was that's giving them this briefing says that heavy flak is expected. Flak is a term that I've heard, but didn't really know quite what it was. It's just anti-aircraft fire, in case anybody wondered. So Jack says, heavy flak? Jack wondered how much flak that was. Light, moderate, heavy were all rather abstract terms until he had firsthand experience. It's true. What exactly is heavy flak? Okay, and how is that different from light or moderate flak? Like I've said 1,000 times before, Jack is my favorite character just because he's one of those characters that he finds trouble and he feels like trouble finds him, but no, he finds trouble. It's different. And the crew is repetitively hazing him and talking about how he better bring some extra toilet paper because he doesn't know what he's in for, etc. And he handles it remarkably well, which, as we learn more about Jack in future books, makes a lot of sense given the fact that he played sports and, you know, he's used to locker room talk and he's extremely intelligent and witty anyway, so he's going to be good at coming up with those comebacks. But this is really where we start to see Jack's character start to build into the person that we know moving forward over the next couple of books. As Jack is sitting in the briefing room, he's really focused on the writer haze, as I refer to it, because I totally understand what this zone is that he is in right here, where he's focused on writing every little detail that he can write, and he's not even really realizing what he's taking in. He's just notes, all the notes, all the notes. He's like filling a notebook throughout this entire experience. He is finding that he can put a damper on his own fear by concentrating concentrating on the minute details of everything around him. So as he's in this briefing room, he's really focusing on the looks on all of these pilots' faces, their closed off emotions, the smoky haze of cigarettes and cigar smoke in the room. And he has the thought, whoever coined the phrase, the greatest generation, must have known these men. That draws such a beautiful mental image in my head as I'm watching these men. Because whenever I read, I see something as a movie in my head. And I know that most of you probably are with me in that. Like, that's how you see it too. But I really just see it. All of these men sitting around watching this plan being drawn out on the board. And this happened so often, like it's a daily occurrence and sometimes a bi-daily occurrence, that they're not even really afraid anymore, if that makes sense. Like they are, but they're able to have a firm grip on their emotions and see it for what it is, which is a job that needs done. Whenever we look at World War II veterans in general, I'm sure that most of you knew a World War II veteran at some point in time. My great-grandfather was one, and he was a very matter-of-fact guy. He was the sweetest guy that you would ever know, but you know, when something needed done, he did it. He didn't complain. He didn't mope about. He just did it. He rolled his shirt sleeves up and he got his hands dirty. And that's the way that this generation of people were. They just didn't ask questions, didn't complain about it. It needed done, so they did it. And that is the kind of thing that we're seeing with these men that Jack is talking about. So they get up in the air and they're headed towards Germany. This is where, after some discussion with Catherine, I'm pretty sure Jack realizes that Cav is not Kenzie's soulmate, because he realizes that Cav is still in love with Susan. And he thinks to himself, well, some women are just natural healers, you know? Maybe that's Kenzie's role in this, to help him heal from this bad breakup. But then he gets to thinking, well, Kenzie's not really a healer. She's more of a fighter. So I'm not really sure if that's it. And I think that this is kind of where Jack kind of starts to put that together. But as they fly over Germany and they drop those bombs, the one thing that Jack thinks, he said, he would never forget what it felt like to run through the burning streets of Richmond, but he would also never forget the feeling of dropping a bomb on an enemy target and watching it burst into flame. So two completely different situations. One, the burning of Richmond is watching the destruction of a place that he calls home, whereas this situation, number two, is watching the destruction of an enemy's property through very intentional means, whereas the burning of Richmond was absolutely an accident. Two very different situations, but equally memorable. And I thought that drew a really cool parallel to Jack's story in Emerald and Sapphire. After they head home is where we start to get into kind of a hairy situation, because the plane gets hit and they're just not able to make it back to England. And so they decide to ditch in the Channel. I didn't know that was a thing. Let me tell you, I didn't know that ditching in the Channel was a common occurrence throughout World War II. But he's able to send his coordinates to a rescue center off the coast of England, and they're able to kind of get a fix on his plane and watch it go down so they know where to send the rescue planes for air-sea rescue. Cav is, by the commander's own admittal, is one of the best pilots that he has, and that if anybody has a chance of, you know, making it out of this situation scot-free, it's Cav and his crew. But I don't think they ever counted on the fact that Jack was the reason that most of them got out alive, because none of them ever thought that they would need to pay attention to their drills for a ditch over the channel or in the sea. They all thought that if they had to get out, they would bail out over land. And so they had no idea what they were doing. Don't ask me how Jack knew. I mean, I'm guessing they maybe went over that in their briefing, but that doesn't, the way that I read it, it sounded more like they learned that in training, not in their briefing for this mission. So who knows? Maybe I misread that. But Jack ends up pushing everybody out of the plane, basically, and tying life preservers onto the wings to help keep them afloat, because it takes over 2 hours for somebody to get there. And he says a quick prayer. He says, Lord, please watch out for some of these men, because I just have a feeling that some of them aren't very good swimmers. One of the things that I want to make note of in this entire situation is David's reaction to finding out that Jack went on this ride-along. David's anger at Jack is unparalleled when he gets this telegram from Cav's commander saying that this plane has gone down, that Cav and Jack were on board. It's not only anger at the situation, but anger at the fact that Jack directly disobeyed orders, cock-blocked David, and risked his own neck. It's like this combination of things. David and Kenzie are literally in the middle of consummating their relationship, and this telegram arrives that says that Jack may or may not be dead. Who knows? Yeah, if I were David, I probably would have punched Jack in the face too. I mean, seriously. And I think you get more of a feel for this situation as you're with David on his way to the airstrip, because David is a soldier, but more than that, he's a commanding officer. And chances are, in the war in Afghanistan, as part of his role as a commanding officer, he had to give death notices to people. And so, worst case scenario, as David's mind likes to do, he's jumped to all these conclusions and he's thinking 10 steps ahead. Well, 10 steps ahead to the worst possible scenario is telling Elliot and Charlotte that Jack has died. He can't imagine that. Like, he knows what that is going to feel like. That pain and anguish. It's not just telling Charlotte that her brother died, telling Elliot that his good friend has died. It's not just that. It's the fact that Jack is David's best friend. And not only is he going to have to give this bad news to people that he really cares about, but he's going to have to process that in some way, shape, or form, he's responsible for this death slash serious injury that he's imagining Jack has suffered because he let Jack go on this mission. It was his choice. He should have put his foot down. He should have said, no, you're not going. You're freaking crazy. You're unstable. You like to get yourself in trouble. And I'm not dealing with that. I have enough on my plate. But he didn't. He let Jack come. So now he's thinking he's going to have to take responsibility for this terrible thing that has happened, that he's worst case scenarioing in his head. I can identify with that so much. That's how my head is. And you know, my mom likes to tell me, don't worry about things that haven't come to pass. It's not doing any good. Blah, blah, blah. Yes, I know, but that doesn't mean I don't worry about it. So I sympathize with David in this situation. So when David punches Jack in the jaw, it was a bit cathartic for not only David, but I think for everybody that was reading this, because they realize, just like David realizes, Jack is a turd, basically. And David says, I don't give a damn how many lives you saved. You're at least half responsible for the most god-awful, gut-wrenching 4 hours of my life, and I include Afghanistan in that. Gather your gear, wrap up your assignment, and get your arse home. Now. He doesn't even give Jack the space of 5 seconds to be like, Kavanaugh is not Kenzie's soulmate, or any of that. He just says, I don't give a flying fuck. Get home now. I'm not dealing with this anymore. I think that was one of my favorite moments of the entire book. Right about the time David heads back to London, something interesting happens. Elliot gets the note from David right about the time in parallel timeline that David is heading back to London to get Kenzie. As Elliot is doing research on this potential man that David thinks might be Kenzie's soulmate, he realizes, oh shit, this is not Kenzie's soulmate because he's Trey Kelly's grandfather. And Trey Kelly is Kenzie's best friend from West Point that ends up saving Kenzie's life. So if Trey doesn't exist, Kenzie dies in Afghanistan, ergo, Cav is not Kenzie's soulmate. This is code red situation, okay? Not great, Bob. Contingency plans have to be put in place. What on earth are they going to do now? It's a shit show, basically. And Elliot quickly realizes that there's really only one option here because of Meredith's ongoing health crisis. He can't go back. So there's only one person left as an option, and that's Kevin. Kevin's the only one left that knows that the brooches exist, knows where Jack and David are, and is in any way, shape, or form prepared to go back and deliver this message. As excited as he is to finally get his opportunity for an adventure, he's also fully aware of the fact that David is likely going to kick his ass when he discovers that he's back in the 1940s, because David specifically told Kevin he did not want him going because David didn't think that he and Kevin both needed to be gone, that Elliot needed at least one of them to stay there. I love how Elliot is like, well, I'm telling you that you need to go, and this situation specifically calls for someone with your skill set. And Kevin's like, oh yeah, what would that be? And he's like, getting in, doing what you're told, and getting back out. Just following orders, that's all I'm asking you to do in this situation. Kevin does go, and he does relay the information to Jack. When Jack first sees Kevin, he kind of panics, and I think this is really another way that we see what Jack experienced in Washington kind of filtering through. He panics a lot more easily. Like, he immediately jumps to the worst possible thing that could happen. He's like, oh my God. And it takes this calming presence of whoever is there with him to kind of be like, it's okay, deep breath. This is not worst case scenario, okay? It's all right. Charlotte's fine. Meredith has surgery planned, but that's not why I'm here. I'm here to tell you that Cav is not Kenzie's soulmate. And Jack's like, well, yeah, I already figured that out. Oh, great. Cool. So I'm here for no reason, basically. I like that Kevin finally got a taste of going back on his own adventure, because what it really does is it starts to expand his role within the family a little bit and show us who he is on a deeper level. And we even get points within the next little bit where we're really starting to understand that Kevin is not this immature early 20s boy that David has it in his head that he is. That's who we as readers have kind of interpreted him to be. And that's why I personally had no idea that Kevin was actually older than David, because I had it in my head that he was just this immature boy who needed somebody to tell him where to go and what to do, and he was incapable of making his own decisions, basically, is kind of the vibe that we get. But we see that Kevin is also very capable of taking in complex and difficult decisions and situations and evaluating that, taking steps that need to be taken. We see that in how he reacts with Elliot and Meredith's situation. He's five steps ahead all the time. As soon as he finds out that Meredith's sick again, he outlines next steps. He's like, I've called this person. I've sent emails to these people. I've set up appointments with these doctors. The plane is fueled and waiting. The pilot is on its way. Like, we're ready to go whenever you are. These are all things that get taken care of lickety split. Likewise, when we look at this situation of him going back, he does research at Bletchley ahead of time, so he kind of knows the layout. He knows what he's getting into, where he needs to go, and where people most likely are. He is extremely prepared. He has the entire situation laid out in front of him of where he needs to look first, who he needs to call, who he can ask for help, etc. Within relatively a few hours, he is done with his assignment and ready to go back to 2000, whatever it is at this point. I think it's very easy without this addition of Kevin's increasing role within the series to view him as a child. So I think it was critical to kind of get this character building a little bit, especially when we bring in Kevin and Kenzie's interactions, because when they get back and he comes back to sew up her head, he's like, I'm Kevin Allen and I'm under threat of serious bodily harm if I don't get you stitched up and out of here as quickly as possible. Plus, I have to do it without spilling any McClina family secrets. So let's get to it. He's so funny. I just think that he has a different outlook on life because he hasn't really had to deal with the difficult things, I guess, like David has. He doesn't have that life experience of being in the military and seeing the worst side of humanity, but he was an EMT, still is at this point, I think, and he has seen some crazy crap. He's not afraid to get his hands dirty either, so we're starting to really see the maturity of that character. And I think where we really start to get an idea of who Kevin really is when we see him through Kenzie's eyes, and then she kind of calls David on it. He's talking about how he sees Kevin is a kid himself because of how much time he spends with James Cullen and Lincoln, which pot calling the kettle black on that. David mentions earlier in the story about how much time he spends with Lincoln and James Cullen and how they basically are the stars around which his universe revolves. So he is really judging Kevin for some of the same things that he does because he doesn't judge Kevin's intent as genuine and mature. So I love that Kenzie kind of calls him out on that. And she's like, I suspect you're the only one who sees him that way. And it's true because when Elliot is debating whether to send Kevin back after Jack and David, he realizes how capable Kevin is. The only thing that he kind of has hesitations about is that I think he kind of feels like he's sending Kevin in unprepared and without backup. And I think that's the biggest thing for him. But he knows that Kevin is capable of handling it. And he trusts him. He even says, he was like, I put Kevin's capability on a scale from David to Jack somewhere in between. So he knows that Kevin is a better choice compared to sending Jack, but not as good of a choice compared to sending David. That's kind of where we are on the scale of 1 to 10. How old is Kevin? 39. Yeah, Kevin's 39 at this point. So not a kid by any stretch. So shit's about to hit the fan in London. Kenzie, she's just looking for clothes, man. That's all she wanted. She just wanted something other than sheets to wear. And so she goes digging in David's duffel, thinking she's going to find a nice big t-shirt to cuddle up in. And instead, she finds a whack uniform, an ID for her, a file with her name on it, and a Dell laptop. Oh boy. And that's when she starts putting together, this guy is from the 21st century. He knows my dad. He's working for my dad. He knows everything about me. He's completed a massive invasion of privacy. And I have a half brother that I know nothing about. I mean, it is just one thing after another after another. She's irate about all of this. And I can't say that I blame her. She's a bit more private than I am. So her reactions over some of the privacy invasions, I thought was a little dramatic, in my opinion. But then again, I know that some people really value their privacy. To me, somebody reading my emails or, you know, searching my house for clues as to my whereabouts when I'm missing isn't that big of a deal. Like, they're doing it to try to find me, but she gets really worked up about that kind of thing, and I try not to judge her too harshly on that. But regardless, you know, that's a massive betrayal in her head. She trusted this guy, and he rescued her from military intelligence, but didn't feel it was important to tell her that he was also from the 21st century and there to help her get home. A couple of like random Kenzie thoughts here as we're processing this invasion of privacy and this complete and utter betrayal that she feels. She's thinking, okay, I had feelings for McBain. A handsome, sexy, caring, lying jerk with potential. Like, you can literally in that sentence feel the war going on in Kenzie's head. And she's like, but I like him, but I'm mad at him, but I like him, but I'm really mad at him. She's funny. And then, you know, eventually they have this come to Jesus moment where they recognize their mutual attraction to each other. And she's completely honest with him. And she says, you're a damn sexy man, McBain, but you lied to me. And I don't know if I'll ever get over that. So she's saying, yes, you are one fine looking individual and I would love to meet you between the sheets any day, but I don't know if I can trust you, you know? And that's gotta be so hard to not have that trust. And the brooch is like, you can feel it, like just gradually tweaking both of these individuals until they line up and come together. In that whole discovery of the truth, she also finds out what we were talking about with the whole her grandfather getting shot and thrown under the bus, and decides that, you know, I don't give a shit if it changes history. I can't let this happen. That's Kenzie's sense of right and wrong that comes to the foreground so much in this book. And for her, letting something like this happen is just a complete and utter waste of time, in her opinion. She's not about to let it happen. And with these credentials that McBain so thoughtfully provided for her, she's able to get into the marshalling area. And so she's starting to develop this plan for going after him, stopping him before he even goes to the inn, and then he won't be shot and he can go with his men to the D-Day invasions and everything will be good. Until Fedora, the bane of everybody's existence in this book. as this story progresses, we really start to understand just how much of a pain in everybody's side this guy is. He was stalking Molly, and he was the reason that that car was parked outside of her house. He was listening in on Kenzie's interview at Bletchley, and now we find out that he's the bastard that shot Kenzie's grandfather. Holy crap! And then when I read it, I was like, of course this guy is the guy that shot Kenzie's grandfather and threw him under the bus and ruined her father's life, basically. Of course. I guess I shouldn't really be surprised. I would say if I had a complaint about this book, it's that this guy didn't get his at the end of this story, okay? I really am sad, I think, that he didn't get shot in the face. I just need him to be unalive, I guess, at the end of this book. When David realizes that Kenzie has gone after her grandfather, he realizes he's up a creek without a paddle, because how on earth is he going to get to her? She's on the last train up to Broadmain. He's thinking, she's going to freaking get herself killed. I'm not going to be able to be there to save her. And this is literally Hot Mess Express. Like, this is the biggest clusterfuck of a mission I have ever put together, and I'm going home with my tail between my legs. There's nothing to be proud about in this situation. So he's pretty dejected, right? His piece of crap car that he's been nursing through this entire book has finally died. There are no more trains for the night. And then he realizes he's outside of the Union Jack Club, which I thought was a neat little parallel to Kenzie. I am always going to highlight these little parallels between the characters. Kenzie somehow, when she landed in 1944 London, landed outside the Rainbow Corner Club, which is the American equivalent of the Union Jack Club. The Union Jack Club is somewhere where any British military personnel can go to get a hot meal and get help. Well, that's sure as hell what he needs. He needs help. And he runs into Lily Ellis, a ferry pilot, who just so happens to be going right where David needs to go. Remember how we were talking about the brooches finding miracles for the heroes of the story? This is one of those. And it also gives us a chance to meet Lily, who is a really, really cool individual. She wanted to be involved in the war effort and didn't want to be a factory worker. So she learned how to be a ferry pilot, and she's currently ferrying a Piper L4 Grasshopper to an airfield not far from where David needs to be. And he actually ends up getting there really close to when he needs to be there. He gets there in time to save Manning from being shot by Fedora Man, so that's a plus. Connie says, coincidence? I think not. Definitely no such thing as coincidence in the Celtic Brooch books, as Elliot is fond of reminding us. While all of this is happening, again, with the pendulum, and I think that this format really helps to create a feeling of organized chaos, I guess. We're going back and forth between what's happening with Kenzie and what's happening with David. Well, while David's trying to find a way to get to Kenzie, we're seeing what Kenzie is going through. She found Manning, but unfortunately, Fedora Man found her. And Manning, we really get an opportunity to see how good of a man he is in this situation. He stands up to this guy, and he's like, look, leave her alone. She didn't do anything wrong. And if you want my help, you'll let her go. Despite the fact that he's doing all of this for Della and his family, he still cares about Kenzie and wants her to be safe, and realizes that it's his duty as an honorable individual to put himself between her and this guy. It's just ironic that she's his granddaughter and he doesn't even realize it. She ends up trying to escape because she's not stupid enough to think that Fedora Man's actually gonna let her live. So while she's trying to escape, she gets shot. Trey tells her to duck, and she only gets grazed on the side of her head instead of getting shot in the back. Seriously, I'm very upset that this guy did not get his. Just saying. And David lights into Manning when he finally gets up to meet him at the inn, because Manning didn't do anything to help Kenzie. And Manning looks at him and he's like, what was I supposed to do? Like, I figured the fastest way to get Kenzie help was for me to accomplish what Need accomplished and go back for her, rather than making a scene and getting myself killed in the process. Like, how would that have helped her? And David kind of has to admit that, well, I guess he does have a point. I think Dave is just so worked up at this point that even the idea of Kenzie being potentially in a life-threatening position, it sets him off because he's really laying on the self-blame, which, yep, you should be beating up on yourself a little bit there, bro. But I think that it's just easier to blame other people versus to beat up on himself when he knows that there's a job that needs done and he can't wallow in self-pity. So he just kind of jumps down Manning's throat instead. Overall, by David and Kenzie being involved in this situation, we get the changing of history that occurs in this book, which a lot of you have said has kind of helped to clarify some of the blurry points from the changing of history situation in Sapphire, which I guess is a silver lining if you look at it that way. But this one, I really love this change in history that was created here because Manning still ends up dying. He just dies a hero in the D-Day invasions. His presence there had a profound impact on what happened that day because he ended up scaling the cliffs and leading his men to find those guns. And despite the fact that he had several bullet wounds, was able to mark the spot for a bomb to drop. Yeah, so he was an extremely big hero in that day. And, you know, as wonderful and fantastic and large scale as that story is, it wasn't a rare occurrence on that day. D-Day was full of tragedy and heroism. You don't have to look far within the annals of history when it comes to that invasion to find something that blows your mind with the amazing humans that helped accomplish that operation. I know, Barb, wasn't that good? I was so hoping he was going to die a hero. I mean, in my opinion, in the original version of history, he died a hero, but it was just smudged over to save people's asses, I feel like. So they land in Normandy, France. There's a bit of a question mark on this. David's like, what is the point of landing here? Why didn't we land in Britain? That would have been a lot easier. But what ends up being the reasoning for the brooches to put them there is that Kenzie gets to understand her family heritage as it is now and to know what happened to this man that she worked so hard to save and risked her life for. In her landing there, it not only brings her and David closer together, but it also helps her to understand how her actions impacted her father's life story and her grandmother's life story. The brooch always has a purpose, and I loved that when Kenzie thanks David for bringing her there, he said, "I didn't, the emerald did." You just have to look for it a little bit, I guess. And we see that as the series progresses. When something happens in a brooch adventure and it's like, well, that wasn't part of the plan. Like, why did we land here? Or why did this happen? Because the brooches have a mind of their own. That's why. And we'll just leave it at that. When they come back, it's a completely altered universe for Kenzie. Not too much has happened for anybody else. It was a very localized change of events, particularly impacting Julian, but it has completely turned his life around and made him a different person. And I think that's really hard for Kenzie to understand and wrap her head around because she's lived her life for so many years as the daughter of a verbally abusive parent. He was angry and abrasive, always had his defenses up, wasn't a great communicator, had a dependency on alcohol. And she comes back to a kind and loving father who hangs on her every word and genuinely cares about her and her life and recognizes how intelligent of an individual she is. He's like asking for her advice on financial statements, and they have this relationship not only between the two of them, but she comes back to a world where her half-brother has known that she existed for most of her life and has helped her to accomplish some of her life goals of, you know, getting into Harvard, getting into Cambridge. They're very close. And so I can imagine Kenzie is just super overwhelmed by the entire situation, but in a completely good way. And I think that probably the best part of all of this for me is that Kenzie gets to share with her dad her experiences with his dad, who he never got to meet. He was such an amazing guy. And so for Kenzie to be able to tell him about all the jokes jokes that they shared and him trying to save her life and just the kind of man that he was and how much he loved his wife and how duty bound he was to his men and to the purpose that they were serving. I'm sure that meant the world to Julian to kind of hear that about his dad, and for Kenzie to be able to share that with him is such a touching thing, I think. Not only is Kenzie coming back to a massively different personal life, but she's also thrown into the middle of the clan, which just keeps expanding. So I think that one of the hardest things that new members of the clan have to adapt to is most of them are, I wouldn't call them rogues, but they're definitely independent spirits and they're used to being on their own. Most of them, with the exception of Jack and Charlotte, don't have family to speak of, and they are kind of enfolded into the group and indoctrinated into this new luxurious lifestyle with instantaneous results, you know, car services and personal shoppers and private jets. Kenzie is just like, what on earth is happening? And I love how David's just like, Elliot makes things happen. Like, that is his explanation for everything, which is true. But I also love that as he's trying to explain to Kenzie who Elliot is, who Meredith is, who Jack and Charlotte and Bram are, she makes the mental comment. She's like, I'm gonna need a scorecard to keep up with all these players, because there are just so many, and she's just being pelted with one thing after another, with Meredith's medical history and that she's having surgery and they think she might have breast cancer, so they're gonna have to go back to Kentucky. And when they're in Kentucky, she's gonna get to meet Charlotte and Bram, and oh, by the way, Bram is a time traveler from the 1860s who personally knew President Lincoln and tried to stop the assassination. While we're in Kentucky, you're probably also gonna meet your new and improved father and your half-brother and everybody else, including all of these kids. Her mind just, I can only imagine that it's just spinning like a bobblehead, just like, oh my God. David completely understands the mind warp that this experience must be. And we really see that in how he prepares her to meet all of these people. He pulls her aside right before they go into the waiting room when they get to the hospital. And he says, before you go in, consider this a whisper in your ear. There will be a room full of people all jabbering at the same time. Smile, hug everyone, tell them you're glad to be back, that you had an incredible adventure, and as soon as you've processed it all, you'll be glad to talk about it. But today is all about Meredith. So he's giving her an out. He's saying, look, I know you're not even close to being ready to talk about everything that happened. They're gonna want to talk about it. So here's what you tell them, and they'll let it ride. He's really looking out for her in ways that she, I don't think, can even comprehend at this point in the story. And that's really David's style in general. He's constantly looking out for everybody, and people don't really understand all the little ways that he has their back until they're up against the wall. One of my favorite conversations for the, oh, we're back storyline is when Jack and David get back together. And literally as soon as David sits down, Jack's like, oh, how's Kenzie? And he's like, oh, she's good. She had a shower. She got something to eat and she rested. And Jack's like, and had sex. David's like, ugh. He tried so hard to leave it alone. And Jack is just like, I told you so. Jack says, your single days are over, my friend. I can hear hearts breaking all over the UK. David McBain is off the eligible bachelor list. And then he said, did you use a condom? And then David's thinking to himself, lying about it would serve no purpose. So he says, no. And Jack slaps him on the back, laughs, and says, I am gonna be your best man, right? Anyway, oh my God, I love their friendship. I want more of that. It's so fantastic. It makes me smile every time I read a scene between those two. Probably everybody's favorite part of this story is the reunion with Cav and Molly. And let me just say, this is such a fantastic part of this story. And I talked to Catherine a little bit about it. She said that it was initially inspired by a commercial that she saw where two old friends from high school or sometime in their youth met again at a retirement home. And that's kind of where this part sprang forth from the spring of creativity. I just thought it was so great. great because, you know, as part of this series, I'm always left to wonder, all these people that they meet in the past, I want to know what happened to them. Did they live a happy life? Did they get married and have children and, you know, send their kids off to college and live happily ever after? I want to know. And we really do get that with Cav and Molly. Obviously, we knew what happened with Cav, that he came home, married Susan, had 5 kids. His only daughter married a Kelly from Chicago, and they ended up having Trey, who ended up being Kenzie's friend. Molly ended up marrying Rainer. This is so cute. Rainer promised Molly that if she married him, he would take her around the world because that was like her one requirement after the war was over. I just want to live my life and see the world. And Rainer wanted to marry her so badly that he was like, I'll give you whatever you want. If you want to fly around the world 300 times, I got you, babe. It was so cute. And then in the lovely way that the brooches work, when Jack put the life raft underneath the wings of the Shamrock to keep it afloat, it ended up making the Shamrock salvageable. So they pulled the Shamrock in, fixed it up, and the ferry pilot that took the Shamrock back to Bassingbourne to be in service was Lily Ellis. And when she dropped the Shamrock off, guess who she met? Cav and Rainer. And they developed this wonderful friendship that ended up leading through the end of the war. And David, whenever he was talking to Lily, while they were on their way to meet Kenzie, he was saying, you know, if you love to fly, don't give it up because there's going to be a major boom in the aviation industry after the end of the war. And I really think that you can find a place there. She had kept that in mind. And when she met Cav and Rainer, they ended up creating this aviation company after the war and were very, very close friends. So this developed this wonderful friendship out of all of this. And I love this. I love it so much. But the one thing that I just can't imagine how shocking it was for these people to realize 70 years later, 60 years later, that the people that they met for the span of a couple of days back in 1944 were actually from the 21st century when they started seeing books come out from David and Jack and saw their jacket covers and then mind blown when they meet their grandson's friend, Kenzie. I just can't imagine how they would process that. And it's like Trey's mom and dad are talking about, they're like, you know, we didn't believe them at first, but when 5 people are so adamant that this is what happened, eventually you start to believe them. When they all have the same story and they're so confident that they're right, you don't have any choice but to kind of buy into it, I guess. And I loved when Kenzie walked into the room and saw Cav and she's just like, hi, Cav. And she's like, you done any dancing lately? Oh, I love that. I love it so much. So they get back from the fantastic Chicago reunion with Cav and Molly. And this is where we get into the quintessential will they, won't they moment that is required for all romance novels. David has made a point to not try anything more with Kenzie because he feels like it would be dishonorable, I guess, to pursue anything without her having the full story, which I'm kind of on board with that. I would kind of be upset with him, I think, if he tried to pursue any additional physical relationship with her, having done the things that he did and her not knowing about it. When she asks him why he hasn't tried to kiss her again, he just says, you know, I have a lot of things to answer for, and I think we need to be on the same page about that before we go any further with this. So whenever he starts to kind of unload on this situation, he starts with the little things, very personal confessions that show his vulnerability, something that bothers him but may not bother everybody. It's like little chinks in his armor that he's revealing to her, like his ulcer, the fact that he gets stressed out, why he plays the saxophone, and kind of the story behind that. He tells all of those things to her to kind of break it in slowly, like showing her that he's not this Superman that the clan might lead her to believe he is. But after they have dinner is when the situation really takes a sharp left, because that's when we really start to get the big whopping revelations about these sketchy things that he's done over the course of the past couple of weeks. We get massive invasions of privacy. He tells her about hacking her social media accounts, her emails, checking out her investment statements, going over her personal calendar, searching her apartment. And honestly, I get that he's laying all the cards out on the table here, but I don't know that bringing the whole soulmate reveal into this massive revelation of all of these quote unquote terrible things that he's done, I just don't know that that was the right move to kind of drop that in on top of everything else. I thought that Kinsey actually handled this very well until she puts two and two together that if he hadn't tried to hold all the cards and had let her make her own decisions, she never would have been captured and tortured by military intelligence. When she realizes that he is the reason that that happened to her, that's a loose interpretation. Because I definitely think, like I said earlier, that they were both at fault for that. I think that's what she views as unforgivable at that point. Obviously, it's not unforgivable because we see how this story ends, but it's the straw that broke the camel's back. She's just absorbed so much information that learning that the worst things that happened to her in the past week happened because of a moment of complete dishonesty. If he had just been honest and straightforward with her from the beginning, none of this would have happened. And I think that's the hardest part for her to swallow. What's difficult to process as a reader about this situation, I guess, is that Kinsey has it in her head that David is not struggling with the decisions that he made and the ramifications of those decisions. I think that she has no clue. Like, whenever she says, I'm going to tell you everything that they did to me in there, and you're going to have to live with that for the rest of your life. Like, I hope it haunts your nightmares type thing. As if it already wasn't. Like, that was the whole point of him watching that medical exam, was he was forcing himself to see what they did to her and mentally flogging himself and blaming himself for what was done to her. That was the whole point of him doing that, and for her to not understand that. That's what he said, you're missing the whole point of this. But I think that was a conclusion that she had to come to on her own. And at the end of the day, after she has the opportunity to take it all in, let it all out, just cry and cry and cry, that's where we really start to kind of see this therapeutic, cathartic, like, just get it out there. And she does eventually understand that it took a lot of guts for him to confess to the things that he did, to put it all out there. He didn't have to be honest with her like that, but he did, because he realized that they didn't have a hope in hell of making any sort of relationship work unless he told her everything. That really put him in a vulnerable position. It's not something that he would brag about. He's not proud of it. In fact, all we learn throughout this entire book is how much he thinks this mission was in the gutter from the very beginning. Like, you might as well just trash it and start over. I think that eventually she comes to realize that everything that he did for her. He didn't do it for him. None of this was for him. And she said, you know, as she's sitting there by the lake thinking about it, she's thinking to herself, he was everything she had ever wanted in a man. An intelligent leader, honest, faithful, and an unusual sense of humor. Loved children and animals. And despite his brief performance, he was one hell of a lover. So literally checks all the boxes. And when she realizes that, yeah, he screwed up, but it wasn't entirely his fault. Yeah, he did invade my privacy, but he did it to find me, to save me. It kind of helps to put a salve on the burn. One thing about the final two chapters from the end, there was a really cool parallel there before and after the dinner, where at the beginning she's talking about catching fireflies and how she feels like she's floating on air and it's this very whimsical, happy ending type thing. And then after dinner, she draws the line of talking about how her life had quickly turned into a dark and twisted, grim fairy tale. And I thought that was a really cool kind of analogy to drag out over the course of this one gut punch after the other when we're talking about all of these revelations that are made. It just turned everything on her head. Whenever he first started to tell her, I'm not gonna try to make a move on you again until I've told you everything, and then you can make the decision on whether you want to pursue this or not, she thinks to herself, if knowing the truth is gonna change change how I feel is going to make me not want him anymore, then maybe I don't want to know. So as much as she values honesty, she has that feeling that it's like, well, maybe I'm better off being naive, which obviously neither one of them was going to let that happen. But it's just interesting that that thought even crossed her mind in all of this. So genuinely, I really feel like the ending of this book spoke to David and Kenzie's unique relationship within the Broach series. I said, David and Kenzie's story ends perfectly for them as a couple, hot and fast, yet sweet. On the heels of the biggest argument they'll ever have, they double down, promise to be everything the other needs, and forgive each other when they're not. They realize that each of them has their faults and that they're gonna screw up, that this is not gonna be perfect, but that if they have each other's backs, at the end of the day, that's really all they can ask, is to be there for each other and lift each other up when the other one needs it. It's a steamy ending. It's perfect. I loved this ending. This is really like the worst that their relationship ever gets. It has a rough start, but then I think they're one of the strongest couples of the entire series. Barb says, I really enjoyed this book and David and Kenzie's relationship. It's a kicker. Like, I loved this book for so many reasons. The time period, the characters, all the full circle moments, the different themes that you see in this book that don't necessarily carry throughout the other books was really cool too. Connie, I love them. They're a solid couple. They really are. Claudine, he stripped himself bare for her. He did, because he realized that that was the only way that they were going to make it through this. He realized that he had to be completely honest and he had to get it across to her who he really is for her to appreciate the situation and understand why he did the things that he did. All right, so my last thing, I asked Catherine, I learned so much about World War II and the events leading up to D-Day through this book. What was your favorite historical event to research for Emerald? She says, probably Bletchley Park, but my trip to Omaha Beach and the American Cemetery, tour of London's World War II locations, flying in the B-17, and my mini email conversations with Steve Ellis George from Broadmain, UK were also favorites. It was a fun book to research. This book would have been so fun to research. I'm slightly jealous if I'm facing facts. I'm slightly jealous of all the cool things because this sounds like so much fun. I've done some cool stuff in the research that I'm doing for my book. And I actually talked to Catherine about that a little bit last week. We were talking about how research is sometimes more fun than the actual book. Oh yes, running on Omaha Beach would be cool. I mean, I don't run, but I can imagine that it would kind of be a surreal experience for sure. Alrighty, guys, that wraps up book club for today. Thanks for sticking it out with me. Make sure to join me and Angela on January 7th at 2 p.m. for our Through the Stones episode to celebrate the 100th episode of the Sassenach Files. Enjoy your holidays, everyone, no matter where you are or what you celebrate. Have a happy holidays and a Merry Christmas, and I'll talk to you after the new year. Bye!